Ryan, chargé de projet à la programmation. Bibliothèque et Archives nationales du Québec et l'Institut Thomas More sont heureux de présenter ce soir la deuxième d'une série de quatre entrevues intitulée « The Culture of Our Cities, Conversations on Today's Urban Experience », au cours desquelles les invités de marque partagent avec le public leur point de vue sur la complexité grandissante de nos villes en expansion. L'invitée de ce soir est Mme Sherry Simon, professeure titulaire au département d'études françaises de l'Université Concordia. Récipiendaire du prix Mavis Gallant 2006, elle a abondamment écrit au sujet de la culture, de la littérature et de la traduction au Québec et au Canada. Elle sera interviewée par Pierrot Lambert et Diane Moreau. Je voudrais maintenant présenter notre partenaire. Fondé à Montréal il y a 62 ans, l'Institut Thomas More offre aux étudiants adultes un programme d'études menant à l'obtention d'un diplôme universitaire en sciences humaines dans une démarche participative où les débats, encadrés par des animateurs expérimentés, remplacent les cours proprement dits. Chaque printemps, depuis 13 ans, l'Institut Thomas More organise une série d'entrevues sur les grands enjeux culturels et moraux de notre temps. La prochaine entrevue de l'Institut aura lieu le 22 mai. Madame Lise Bissonnette, présidente directrice générale de Bibliothèque et Archives nationales du Québec, sera l'invitée de l'Institut. L'entrevue de ce soir est enregistrée et vous pourrez la réentendre en balado-diffusion sur notre site Internet. Cette entrevue, qui se déroule en anglais, sera suivie d'une période de questions. Sans plus tarder, je cède la parole à nos invités et je vous souhaite une bonne soirée.
Welcome to the second part of our four-part Thomas More Institute series, Spring Series, which will be here in the Bibliothèque Nationale du Québec. My name is Christine Jameson. I'm one of the board members of the Thomas More Institute, and I have the privilege of being able to introduce our panel tonight. The person who will be interviewed is Professor Sherry Simon, who is a professor at Concordia University in the Department of Études Françaises. Professor Simon studied comparative literature and semiology in France under Roland Barthes, and later she did her doctorate at the University of Montreal. She was co-editor of the Quebec Cultural Review Spiral for 10 years. She directed the interdisciplinary PhD in Humanities program at Concordia from 1995 to 2000. Her research areas are translation theory and literature, focusing particularly on questions of cultural identity. She was the Canada Research Chair in Translation and Cultural History in 2005 at the Glendon College, York University. She has written extensively on the ways in which Quebec writers and filmmakers of different origins have developed aesthetic responses to changing collective identities in Quebec. Sherry Simon is, according to one source, one of the most influential voices of the Canadian avant-garde group of translators. She has an extensive list of publications, and I'll just mention a couple. She's the author of Gender in Translation, which was published in 1996, which was a very important book that came out. She was also recently published a book titled Translating Montreal, Episodes in the Life of a Divided City. This came out in 2005. This book was awarded the Quebec Writers Federation Mavis Gallant Prize for Nonfiction in 2006. In addition, it's just been awarded the Gabriel Roy Prize given by the English language criticism. At the core of her teaching in her books is the observation that every translation is a rewriting of the original and a new work of art. So I think that we'll have a very interesting evening with the interview with Professor Simon. Interviewing Dr. Simon are two longtime members of the Thomas More Institute. Diane Moreau was the former curriculum coordinator at Thomas More Institute, where she was responsible for course design. Her own courses, her own designs are in classical and world literature. Some of her courses include the Iliad and the Odyssey, Proust, Don Quixote, and Dante. Originally, she was from California, where she attended California University at Sacramento, where she studied Romantic languages and literature, and where she received her BA and her teaching credentials in Spanish and French. She pursued her MA at the Nevada University in Reno. She immigrated to Canada in 1975, and she's lived in Montreal since that time. She's been working at the Thomas More Institute for around 12 years. The second interviewer is Pierre Lambert. Pierrot is a retired director of translation services for the Human Resources and Development Canada. He is also the overseer of the Bernard Lonergan website in French, a French Bernard Lonergan website, which is responsible for diffusing the thought of Bernard Lonergan, the Canadian theologian and philosopher. Pierrot translated Lonergan's enormous book, Insight, A Study of Human Understanding, which was published, the translated published version was published in 1996. This was nominated for the 1997 Governor General's Literary Award for translation from English into French. In addition, Pierrot has translated many other works and many other of Lonergan's works, including Topics in Education. So I'll let our interviewers now begin with their questions to Dr. Simon for about an hour, and then I will come up and we will have an opportunity to ask questions from the audience. So thank you very much.
Hello. In the beginning of your book, you tell two little personal... Is the mic not working? Well, maybe it's too far away. So, is it okay now? No?
To be closer.
All right. So I have the first question, so I have to do the testing with the mics. In the beginning of your book, which is the book that we're talking about today, is Translating Montreal, Episodes of a Divided City, you tell two little personal stories, which really struck Pierrot and I, and we'd like to ask you about, because they seem to be contradictory, but we suspect that they're not. And the first one is about your mother, and I'm going to paraphrase the story like you tell it in the book. You say that your mother was an adventurer, and that she was always astonishing her friends, because she was a physiotherapist at Notre Dame Hospital, and later she completed an arts degree at UQAM, and that these crossings were part of the journey that helped her to become an artist, which she still is today. And the other story that you tell is about yourself growing up in Montreal at a time when it was as segregated as Calcutta, and you used to hop on an Easttown bus going east, and you kept transferring every chance you got, going in deeper and deeper into the East End until it was time for you to come back home. And the interesting thing is that you kept these trips a secret because you were barely a teenager, and you realized that it was the first venture into transgression and really confronting cultural differences. So our question was, were you just talking about being a rebellious teenager, or was that crosstown journey across the Maine, Saint Laurent, into the East End of town, was that a transgression? And if so, how is the crosstown journey, both the creative act that it was for your mother and a transgressive act?
Thank you for a tricky and a very lovely question. I think I'm pleased to bring my mother into this story because she is a very important part of Montreal for me, and she always made the city such an important part of our upbringing. That contradiction did strike me at one point in my, as I was writing this, the acknowledgments which I wrote, where I write the story of my mother, came after the story where I wrote the story of myself. So I think I had the impression that I was being the adventurer and that no one had gone there before, and that my mother's story was somehow in the background. There's also a time difference. I was talking about when I was very young, and I think my mother's transgressions, or not transgressions, but her cross-town adventures began a bit later. But certainly we as children in our school environments and in everything that we knew about the city understood very clearly that that line, that mythical and important line, was a divining line that separated the two parts of Montreal. And for many people, that line was an irritant, and it was a something that seemed very negative. But for others, it was the opening, something that opened on to new possibilities. Franco Moretti, who's a literary critic, says that any line, a dividing line, is a plot waiting to happen. And I think that that's the case in Montreal. You had this dividing line. It was actually inviting transgression. It was inviting you to cross. When I reread my book, I was surprised to see to what extent I did, that there's a lot in the book that has to do with transgression, that has to do with disobeying. So I tell the story of being in a convent and for the first time finding myself in a convent for a Model United Nations. I soon later found out that I had other friends who were possibly around the same time doing the same thing. But for me, it was, we were sort of plucked out of our own high school milieu and taken to a convent for this Model United Nations. And what happened there was very predictable. It was how to do things that the nuns didn't want us to do. So I found myself one evening smoking a cigarette in the bathroom with one of my Francophone co-students. And it was, differences are there in a sense to be exploited for whatever they'll give you. I mean, I had the sense, as a child, that the differences, I think a lot, all we all did, had the differences, that the differences in Montreal were enormous, that they were walls, that they were, these were parallel histories, you know. The story of Montreal goes back, you know, observers talking about the history of Montreal have observed for the last 300 years that this was a city that was extraordinarily divided. Stephen Leacock says that the city is as divided, as it's as extraordinary as it is unfortunate how divided the city is. And of course, then you have Hugh McLennan and Two Solitudes. It was a city whose main characteristic was this dividing line. Mm-hmm. It was in some sense a myth. It was in other senses an opportunity. It was also a barrier. But that dividing line was part of our consciousness as Montrealers.
But what's so exciting about the book is that you say that translation is actually the tool and the lens for us to penetrate and understand these cultural differences that seem to divide us. And when you translate, or translating from one culture to another is actually done through a passage which acts as a buffer zone or a mediation point or a common space that all cultures enjoy. And this passage is literally grounded in the geography of Montreal. So we just talked about the Maine, but you also talk about Montreal as an island and the Jacques Cartier Bridge and the mountain even as a utopian space. And you talk about the Mile End District, which I happen to know is still your own neighborhood. Could you speak to us about the Mile End neighborhood and give us a sense of how that works as a passage of translation?
Yes, well, the divisions of Montreal were so emblematic in a certain way. I'm not sure there are other cities there are a certain number of cities in the world, let's say, that show differences so graphically, so emblematically. So you have Montreal was divided by this mythical St. Lawrence Boulevard, and then conveniently around the center around St. Lawrence, you had the immigrant neighborhoods. That's where the immigrants lived, as if they were seeking out a buffer zone between French and English. I mean, that's the way it worked out, that in fact, it's still a very much immigrant neighborhood. Montreal has many more immigrant neighborhoods now, and it's become a very different city geographically and socio-demographically. When I was growing up, and in those days, let's say, between the 40s and the 60s, the divisions of the city were kind of stark reminders of these strong differences, English and French, confronting each other. And in the middle, this population of neither nors, if you like, who were the immigrants speaking immigrant languages. It was very, for a long time, a Jewish neighborhood. But there have been many, many other populations that have lived in Mile End, Greeks and Latin Americans now, and Portuguese, and so on. And it's a neighborhood that waves of immigration kind of wash over, but at the same time leave some of their people behind. So some people will stay, and it becomes more and more diverse. The author that, to me, was the most emblematic of this neighborhood is a poet called A.M. Klein, who lived in this neighborhood and whose writing is in many ways a space of translation in the same way that the neighborhood is a space of translation. I brought my kids up in this neighborhood, and I always felt that it was one of the greatest gifts that I could give them, was to live in a neighborhood where there were so many languages, so many differences, where, one family, there were many mixed couples in the neighborhood. It's as if the neighborhood itself has elicited a kind of mixed identity that people enjoy. So starting to speak in one language and finishing in the other. I'm sure you're all familiar with the way kids talk today in Montreal. And that was very much, to me, Mile End speak, to start your language in French, and your sentence in French and finish it in English, and maybe throw in a few words of some other language somewhere in between.
Thank you.
You talk about the bridge. You say that translation is a bridge. And somewhere else you say that self-understanding, you use the metaphor of the bridge for self-understanding. You write, what happens on the bridge must be taken into account. The trajectory is as meaningful as the goal. And somewhere else, the bridge of translation may or may not guarantee passage. Does it matter if it doesn't guarantee passage as long as the process is underway?
Ah, that's a hard question. That's a lovely question. Thank you. Yes, I think the process is important, the process of trying to understand. I think when I talk about different experiences on the bridge or different ways of crossing the bridge, I'm also saying that there are different kinds of translations and there are different goals for translation. Elsewhere I make a distinction between what I call cool and warm translations. Mm. So cool translations are translations that don't disturb anything. The author I'm thinking of most there is Frank Scott. During the 1950s and 60s, F.R. Scott was a poet and a translator, an excellent translator, but he believed in literal translation. And he also believed in not disturbing the differences that existed at that time. That was very important for him, to recognize differences as they were, but not to in any way change those differences. So that he, for instance, as a poet, was very involved with Francophone poets, was one of the first to cross town, to go to openings of books, launchings of books here on Saint-Denis or Saint-Hubert, or as we're in the neighborhood we are now. But then he'd go home at night. He'd invite poets over to his house as well. He was one of the first to do that, French-Canadian poets. But he still lived in Westmount, let's say. Mm-hmm. And his translations didn't aim to bring the communities together in a kind of genteel and conversational way, but not to disturb everyone's own identity. That is what I consider to be a cool kind of translation, whereas a warmer kind of translation is when translation leads to something else, when it disturbs the status quo in, I think, a positive way. So when a book is translated and it leads to new translations, it sets something off. A writer like Jacques Brault seems to me to represent that kind of translation. So in relation to the bridge and how we cross the bridge, I think there are sort of various sorts of ways of doing it. But there's another thing about the bridge, too. The bridge is a very conventional figure for talking about translation communication. You know, bridge will bring us closer one to the other. But in fact, when we think of bridges, we often think of these sort of flat slabs of concrete that get you from one place to the other. But as you know, in the Middle Ages, bridges were places that people set up shop and where people lived and did their commerce. There's also the bridges. I was just recently came back from Istanbul, which has a wonderful bridge called the Galata Bridge. It's a very ancient bridge. And the second floor of that bridge is cafes. So you can sit on the bridge in a cafe and watch the water. So bridges are also places where you can do things. It's not simply to cross. And in the same way, I think the translation is a place that we inhabit. We live in translation in Montreal. We're not in a hurry to get from English to French. We live kind of in that space between. And that's an engaging place. That's a place that we enjoy.
In the preface of your book, you also mentioned Mavis Galland's own displacement. I think her parents put her when she was still 4 years old. She was from a Protestant English-speaking milieu, and they put her in a French-speaking Catholic board. She says this experience was the very beginning of her writing career. Would you say Montreal has provided so many writers because the city fosters the experience of otherness better than other places, perhaps?
Yes. Two writers were really very important for me when I began this book. And one was Mavis Galland because of this story. And as she says, this experience of otherness was the exact beginning, she says, of her writing career. The other is Gabrielle Roy, who says something similar. It's not related to... Gabrielle Roy wrote about Montreal. You know, she wrote Bonheur d'Occasion, The Tin Flute, which became a very important book about Montreal. But Gabrielle Roy was born in Winnipeg, but really in Saint-Boniface. And she talks about the bridge and her travels with her mother between Saint-Boniface and Winnipeg. And it's similar in feeling to what Mavis Galland says. They're different stories, but they're similar in feeling. And Gabrielle Roy says that crossing the bridge between Saint-Boniface and Winnipeg was also for her the beginning of her writing career. And it's this idea that difference, such extreme, what seemed to us as extreme difference, of course differences have exploded now, and what seems like a huge difference to us when at a certain time seems perhaps smaller now. But this encounter with difference, which is so close by, a bus ride away, or a short walk away, where you can go from one village to another village. Mavis Galland talks about these mossy little ponds. She says English Protestants lived in one pond, French Catholics lived in another pond, and never the two ponds would they meet. But they were so close together. So in Montreal, you had this sort of experience of what I could call intimate otherness, close, proximate differences, you know, where differences, this is something that's very germane to a colonial city, right, where you have two different sort of groups living very close by. And Montreal had this proximity of difference. And I think that was a very important spark for writers, not only in sort of cultural difference, but language difference, the idea of living in two languages. And I think we see today that there's not only in French, but a tremendous dynamism in English language writing in Montreal today. It's an English language writing which is very much in contact with French in the same way as Mavis Galland or Gabrielle Roy.
So there's an experience of distance which is very important for translation vocations.
Yes.
Translation writers' vocations.
Yes. Well, writers who are in some way translators as well.
I had a question. You mentioned the bridge. Bernard Lonergan, who's I translated a few books, I said to a friend of mine that if he would have written Insight in French, he would have structured the book differently, and he would have used different examples for his theories. I discussed a little bit with Bernard Lonergan himself before translating Insight. But would you say that's an illustration that translation is never an achieved work? Like the passage is never, like the book is now in French, but it has been structured for an English audience. Would you say that it is always a half, it falls short of a real achievement?
That a translation is somehow always incomplete?
Yes.
That's a way of, yes, I think that in some ways translations are always incomplete. Sometimes they're voluntarily incomplete because writers and translators want the reader to sense the other language behind what's being written. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not sure if that was your goal when you did that. Did you want the reader to have a sense that perhaps, you know, that this book belonged in some way to the English language purview and in some ways to the French?
No, it's just that on reflection, I discussed, I would like Lonergan to write himself the book for a French audience. I cannot do that, of course. I can put his words with the structure, the English structure in French. But, what I mean is a real translation would be a rewriting for a different audience.
Yes. On the other hand, I think translations can and do very much do what they have to do, and what in the sense of conveying meanings of other works. I mean, we live in a world of translation. We read so much foreign literature in translation, and we do enter into those worlds. With philosophy, of course, it's somewhat different. I guess you could say philosophy and religion, because they're grounded in concepts. And concepts are perhaps a little bit more difficult to move than descriptive prose, for instance. Concepts are often grounded in intellectual tradition, which is often language grounded. So there are different degrees of difficulty depending on the kind of material that you're transferring. But as far as literature is concerned, for instance, I was just reading an article by Milan Kundera, who brings back the 18th century idea of Weltliteratur, which was world literature, which was put forward by Goethe, and which he very much still believes in. That is to say that we share a common literature, especially in terms of Europe, European literature, and that we can read in translation just as well as in the original. That this sense that we're, you know, that we're going to be missing something essential. Well, of course, it's better to read in the original, but translations are there to fill in, you know, those aspects of our perspective that we would otherwise be lacking.
What has the translator Pierre Anctil done in recent years that is so different, so special and unique here in Montreal?
Yes, Pierre Anctil is a terrifically interesting success story to talk about. I think it's very much a success story. Pierre Anctil is an academic, also someone who was very active in politics and in intercultural relations for a while. But he has this particular characteristic, and I think you might be surprised when I tell you this. Pierre Anctil is a non-Jew who learned Yiddish. This is a very unusual thing. It's something like, an American native person learning Breton. You know, it's a kind of a crossover that you don't expect. So he learned Yiddish, and he's been translating works of Yiddish language writing in Montreal for the last 20 years or so, and he's published some 10 books at least. And he's also written essays explaining in French the world of Yiddish language literature. And he's had a tremendous impact. I can say that my own interest for Yiddish-speaking literature in Montreal was awakened by him. Because he's been translating from Yiddish into French, some works that had not been translated into English yet were then translated into English because he had done them in French. So what has he done? He's reversed what he would call the natural slope of Yiddish into English. He's kind of made some sort of engineering feat and reversed the flow of water from our language from English into French, translating directly from Yiddish into French, and at the same time redirecting the cultural relations of this city, that is to say, bringing Jewish experience, the Jewish experience of the past, of the 1930s, of the 1940s in Montreal. You might know that for the first 50 years of the 20th century, Yiddish was the third literary language in Montreal after French and English. It was extremely vibrant literary language with publications, communities, all kinds of activities going on. And this literature was, because there are fewer and fewer Yiddish speakers, this literature was really available only in translation. And generally speaking, it had been translated into English. But with Pierre Anctil, not only has he done the translation, but he's inspired a whole generation of people to become interested in this world, which otherwise would have fallen slowly into oblivion.
For all practical purposes, it was just about dead in Montreal. I mean, at the time of World War II, immigration was over, and there were no longer Yiddish speakers.
Well, there were very few. There were still Yiddish speakers in the sense of older people, and new immigrants in the sense that the Hasidic community does actually speak Yiddish. Mm-hmm. Today, even today, they speak Yiddish, but they're not, let's say, participating in the literary world. That it's a different Yiddish world that they live in. But some writers, Chava Rosenfarb, who was one of the most wonderful Yiddish language writers, is still alive today and still writing in Yiddish. She lived in Montreal for a long time. Now she's living in Lethbridge. But to a great extent, Yiddish was dying as a literary language. The community of Jewish writers was dying out. So yes, he's done a remarkable thing by bringing this literature to our attention. And at the same time, I mean, what is extremely significant about what he's doing is creating a direct connection between this Yiddish language milieu and this history and today's French Canadians, who were, in some senses, they're not the direct descendants of those people. And yet they lived on the same streets. They went to the same commerçants. Pierre Anctil likes to imagine the 1930s and the 1940s and remember how French and Yiddish would be heard together on the same street, Saint-Laurent, for instance. And also the combination of French and Yiddish was very beautifully recombined in the Yiddish translation of Les Belles Sœurs, which a great classic of French Canadian literature, as you know, which was played in Yiddish at the Sadie Bronfman by the Yiddish Theater Company.
But Pierre Anctil is still a classical translator. He's an historian and anthropologist. But there are a lot of translators today active in Montreal that are not traditional at all. And in fact, at one point in your book, you send out a warning and an invitation at the same time to your reader to to be brave and to explore encounters of translation when they meet the pleasures of perversion. That was the way you phrased it. So what is a perverse translation? And who are the people today who are doing this type of translation?
That's part of the. I think that's part of the transgressive theme in the book as well. Is the idea of these perverse translations that don't follow the rules that translations are supposed to follow? That is to say, a translation is supposed to lead from an original to a replacement, and the two are kind of separate entities. But there are a number of writers in Montreal today, and I think more and more, who write at the border of these two languages, who play with language, who try to use French and English or English and French. A lot of it is Anglophone writers now, I think. And I say somewhere that, in fact, I think it's because Anglophones are exploring a way of being members in a new way of the Montreal community. So they're exploring ways of entering into contact with the Francophone world through their writing. So you have a writer like Robert Maisels, for instance, who uses a great deal of French in his writing, or Gail Scott, who also invites French into her English language writing. One of the best examples, though, is Jacques Brault, who's a French language writer, a very, very eminent poet who has received all the major prizes. And he's done some very interesting work where he translates with Ted Blodgett, who's a poet from Alberta. And they have done these, what they call transfiguration, which is a kind of dance that they do with one another. Jacques Brault would write a poem, a short poem in English, send it to Blodgett. Blodgett translates it and writes a new poem in English, sends it back. Brault translates it and writes a new poem, and there it goes on. And this is a very small book, and it's called Transfiguration, and it very paradoxically won the Governor General's Prize for Translation for Jacques Brault, because what's paradoxical is that it's absolutely, in a sense, nonsensical, because there is no author. Each time the poem travels from one to the other, mm-hmm. it loses its mm-hmm. authorship, and it just becomes a very intricate and playful dance. It's also beautiful, beautiful poetry. Because they're both very accomplished writers. But playing with language in that way, where the notion of authorship gets lost, and where the final product is some sort of a dialogue between poets, between languages, and becomes an expression of a friendship between the two poets, at the same time as they're sort of playing with their own languages, is really a very one of the very lovely examples of perverse translation. Jacques Brault is from Montreal, and so he's very much comes out of the tradition of the divided city. There are other writers who are doing similar kinds of games, but I think it's the idea of defying the borders between language and playing with them, just as we see in advertising in Montreal, where sometimes you have these kinds of games, or in graffiti. And my very favorite example of bilingual graffiti was this one. Last year, it was a provincial election, I believe. And I believe that it was the PQ's motto was "Osez, osez." So someone had the very clever idea of putting an L in front of "osez." Do you know what you get?
Yes.
Loser. that was very
that
brilliant.
Was really good.
That's poetry.
You have to understand English, though.
Yeah, you have to understand both languages.
Yeah. You know, I'm really glad you gave that example, because I have to ask this question. What intrigued me all through the book is, why the religious vocabulary? I mean, you use transgression, and we had perversion, and then at some point you say conversion, and you just said transfiguration. So my question is there attached to translation the possibility of self-transformation? Or transcendence, and who is it for? Is it for the translator, or where does the author fit in, if that is the case?
Well, I'm not sure if I should thank you for that question. I hadn't really seen all of those implications.
There was also inversion and a few others like that.
Yes, conversion, inversion, perversion, which I play with because of translation being a version from the Latin.
But you did say secular transfiguration, but still the transfiguration.
Yes, I hope it's resolutely secular because that's really where I stand. Mm-hmm. But self-transformation, I think, is a very secular sort of thing. And there are this reminds me of the bridge question. You know, where does a translator stop? Where does a translator? How great is the translator's empathy with the original? And what are the kind of distances that the translator has to keep to be successful? So, in fact, we know that a good translator should really know one language well and not two. Because if you know both languages too well, you're likely to sort of fall over, you know, basculer into the other language and perhaps into the other culture. You know, the position of the translator is a very uncertain one. It's between languages, but that's why the translator has always been accused of unfaithfulness and betrayal, right? Because the translator is in such an uncertain and difficult position. Where are the loyalties of the translator to their new public or to the work that they have translated? So it's an eternally difficult question. And one of the people, one of my characters in the book who I speak about, Malcolm Reed, who in the 1960s wrote this absolutely fabulous book about the Parti Pris movement in Montreal. He was one of the first, he's in a sense one of the stars of my book because he for him the voyage across Montreal was very much a voyage of self-transformation. Because he was writing about a political and a cultural and a literary movement that he thought was absolutely the most important at that time. And he thought that the political truth was to be found among Francophones, among this very self-conscious group of anti-colonial writers. And he wrote this book, The Shouting Sign Painters, in English. It's a beautiful book, which I absolutely recommend. But then he, in a sense, kept on traveling because he traveled east and married and went to live in Quebec City. So in a sense, he never came back. You know, a translator, like Frank Scott, you go out during the day, you enjoy yourself, you meet other people, but you come home at night. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, the translator's job is to come home and to bring the other work home. But for some translators, they get caught up, they get stuck, and they don't come home. They voyage onward. And in some sense, they become transformed so that they're no longer a good translator. They become a bad translator because they've fallen into the other language.
So it impacts on what we would consider to be the ethics of translation then?
Yes, very much so.
So then sometimes in perverse translations, when the author seems to get lost, I mean, how can we trust the translator or should we trust him? Or it gets difficult for the reader's reaction too sometimes.
I think so. The question of trust is very important. I don't know if any of you have read a novel by Italo Calvino called If on a Winter's Night a Traveler, and it's a long sequence of... It's a novel that has as its character someone called the author and someone called the reader and someone called the translator. And the translator is someone... His name is Hermes Morana, and the translator is a scoundrel, really. And he commits frauds, and he in fact, this is the stereotype of the translator in a certain sense. Can we trust the translator? You know, do we? But I think it depends on the kind of on the finality of the translation. Yes, most of the time we absolutely can trust the translator. But when the translator becomes playful in the way that we've talked about, but shows us up front that they are going to be playful, then we're dealing with something different. So I think that if translators are going to be playful, they should tell us.
Okay. Thank you.
You have some remarks about Canada's official bilingualism and about what you call mirror image, two-tongue politics. And having been a member of the Federal Translation Bureau for quite a while, I thought that reflects not only official policy, but also the gap between literary translation, where you have more freedom, and administrative translation. Is that right? Or?
Yes. Sure. There are different kinds of translation, but there are also translations for different ends. That is to say, that the image that is projected by bilingualism, federal bilingualism, is that of perfect symmetry. So when you look at a translation produced by the government, English and French look the same. They're facing paragraphs. Most of the time they're tête-bêche, but they're made to, you know, assume the same size, to look like mirror images one of the other, and to promote the idea of a country where those two languages are the same. Well, we know they're not the same. They're not the same. There are many more English speakers than French speakers. There's a different history. Official bilingualism has to do with the fact that our government institutions are bilingual. This is a fact. But the social reality of what, you know, how our languages react, the fact that there are many, many more languages than English and French that circulate in this country, these are realities that are often in some ways hidden because of that policy of bilingualism. So the policy, of course, is very sound and does its job, but I think it's our image of the country and of the languages of the country that's much more... the country is much more unruly, much more messy than those neat paragraphs lead us to believe.
But the Official Languages Act has had an impact on the job of professional translator, and probably on not only on the offer of government services, but also on a city, on the practice of that passage from French to English and back.
Absolutely. I teach at Concordia in a translation program. Part of the work I do is in translation, and we train translators, and this is extremely important, and they are extremely well qualified, for sure. And Canada is known worldwide for this. But again, if you look at the street, if you look at what's happening out there, of course, we know that what happens in Montreal, the realities of Montreal, this kind of border crossing that goes on so often, the way that the English language in Montreal has been really invaded by French, and everybody's doing their inscriptions and when they go to school and getting their words wrong, and of course French having been so long contaminated by English. These are struggles that are going on all the time, and you might have a formal level where translations are impeccable. I mean, we've really got a very solid, thanks to, you know, people like you who have done such an amazing job, we have a very, very solid professional translators. But that's not the whole world of translation.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a very interesting note by Klein saying, Montreal's invented language is created on the basis of a Norman vocabulary common to both English and French. Now, my question is, what was the impact of television and cinema? I know I was raised in Sherbrooke, and when people started being exposed to French coming from Paris, it changed a little bit their own language, what you call sometimes déclassé French. At least we were exposed to a more international French. That's an interesting feature in the evolution of...
Yes, that each of the languages, whether French, English, or other languages, were always in competition, not only with each other, but with other versions of themselves. Where this note that where A.M. Klein talks about Norman French is something that he really, in a sense, made up, I think. he wrote this very wonderful poem called Montreal, which he writes in a mixture of languages, which I think is just an experiment that's just extremely exciting. I think it hasn't been done again. I think that's the defi, you know, that we should the challenge that we should bait that we should try to get to today is to write a new version of that language, of that poem. But his poem was what he considered to be words from that had a common origin. So what we call cognates today, you know, which are French words that are same in English and in French. But he put them together. He used the word escaliered, for instance, when he was talking about the spiral staircases, escaliered, and I don't remember them now, but he was playing on the similarities between English and French.
Mm-hmm. I was trying to find the poem. I would have it sort of marked. It would have been nice for you to read it. But you tell an interesting story about Leonard Cohen that we might like to hear, and that's... it's a little bit opposite of what Piero just asked you, and that's Leonard Cohen was very unhappy about his Parisian publisher's translation of Stranger Music, and he asked one of his friends to give a less literal translation. I think the Parisian translation was Musique d'ailleurs, which is not what he meant.
That's right.
And Marc Garneau, I believe his name was, the translator here, came up with Étrange Musique étrangère,
yes,
which he was very happy about because... For him, the literal translation was less meaningful than one that was more creative by the translator. So can meaning actually come about even more, even from the author, from the translator, from his original piece? Or, that's a strange...
The translator can bring something new
to the... He can bring something to the meaning, cultural, because he that the author was even pleased about and enhanced his own...
Yes, that's a very nice example of that. It's very rare that publishers allow something to be retranslated. Usually, the publisher buys the rights, and that's it. So the there are very few examples of retranslation. But one of those was Leonard Cohen, who knows enough French, of course, to realize that the French version of his book, which he called Stranger Music. Was just not up to, was really just very very stiff, and he didn't like it. And he had Michel Garneau was a friend of his. I just read recently, in fact, Michel Garneau has just translated another one of them. Michel Garneau is a very well-known poet, playwright, dramaturg. He's a very eminent Quebec cultural figure, and he was responsible for Leonard Cohen moving into the neighborhood that you know where he lived, which was around the Place des Portugais. And that's what he just mentioned in a recent interview, because you know where the Bagels, etc., is. I mean, that's where Leonard Cohen had his place, right around there. And they were very good friends. And I guess they were talking one night, and when they looked at the translations, it just didn't stand up. So Michel Garneau translated and came up with a new version. And yes, instead of musique d'ailleurs, music from somewhere else, which was his version, the French translator's version of Stranger Music, Michel Garneau wrote étrange musique étrangère, making sure that you understand the two meanings of strange, that is, stranger and odd or foreign. That's another example of the kinds of translations that I talk about in the book, that is, translations that come about because of friendships, because of living together in the same place, translations that make sense because the translator understands, you know, really deeply the work of his friend and wants to bring that to light. Too many English language works have been translated in Paris and often... badly. There's a very egregious example of a bad translation, which you may have heard of, which is Barney's version by Mordecai Richler, translated as Le Monde de Barney by a certain Bernard Cohen in Paris, and it's just full of mistakes. And yet it's a book that you'll still see on the bookshelves here, because once it's published, that's it. And the kinds of mistakes it has are just unbelievable. That is to say, the rocket, as in Rocket Richard, is called La Fusée. You know, that's just one of the examples. It's filled with examples like that. Lower Canada is le Canada inférieur. It's extraordinary. And that translation exists. That's what you'll find in the bookstore. Mm. When you go to buy Barney's version.
The translator didn't try to inform himself.
That's right. Blame the translator. I know I shouldn't be doing that because one wants to promote translators and say that. But obviously, in this case, the translator didn't take the time to try to figure out what the cultural realities were. Funnily enough, I'm not sure how well that novel is doing in France, but the Italian version of Barney's version became a bestseller in Italy. Mm. So, go figure. Mm.
The subtitle of your book is Episodes in the Life of a Divided City. And you mentioned some other cities in the world which are divided cities. I think Trieste and others.
Yes, and Calcutta. And yes. I started to think about Montreal and Montreal's divisions. Of course, the question becomes, is Montreal unique? In what sense is Montreal unique? People will say, Montreal, there is no equivalent. It's a city where these two languages have grown up side by side, where two communities have in some sense felt at home, more or less, at different times in their existences, where two or more communities will lay claim to the same territory. So what other examples can we think of divided cities that are similar to Montreal? So first, I discounted a whole bunch of cities that I consider not like Montreal, and these are the cities where divisions have led to violence. And those cities are Belfast and Beirut and Jerusalem and other B cities. A city like Mostar, for instance, in Bosnia, which has a bridge that goes from between the two, but in fact the bridge is just a symbol of the fact that the two cities are totally separate now since the war. So those are the cities that Montreal is not like, because for whatever reason we have escaped violence. And that's really remarkable considering how close the last referendum was, for instance. But we have. So Montreal is not a city whose divisions have led to violence. It seemed to me that Montreal is a colonial city. It's a funny colonial city, because usually colonial cities are cities that have a foreign, that is to say white, population living with an indigenous population, if you look at African colonial cities or Indian colonial cities. But Montreal is a sort of, to the second remove, a colonial city. The indigenous population disappeared or was covered over, and we had a first colonization, which was French, and then a second colonization, which was English. And that those two colonizations remained the main traces in the city. So a city like Calcutta in the 19th century, which was very much a divided, racially segregated city. But at the same time, at the end of the 19th century, Calcutta had a cultural renaissance where the contact between those two cultures gave birth to an extraordinarily important, it was called the Bengali Renaissance, and it was a literary, political, cultural movement which was very positive. Then you have the Habsburg cities, which seem to me also to have an analog, because in the Habsburg cities in the 19th century, you had, like Montreal, an imperial language or a cosmopolitan language, which in that case was German, next to an emergent national language, which were Czech or Hungarian or Italian in the case of Trieste. So those cities seem to me, those are in that 19th century models of those cities seem to me to have the same sort of, in all those cases there was a cultural renaissance. So there was an important flowering of culture in Trieste, in Kafka's Prague, for instance. So where the divisions, what I'm looking for are divided cities where the contact between cultures was positive, gave birth to important modernist cultural movements.
But later in the book, you state, the divided city comes to a new self-understanding, no longer partitioned between two strong identities. It is now a place of diversity where immigrant populations are fully visible. Would you say it is not a divided city anymore?
Yes, that was a problem with my, in a sense, with the subtitle of The Divided City. I don't think that Montreal today is the same divided city it was. When I talk about episodes in the life of a divided city, I think, and I thank you very much for that question, because I think that the divisions of the past, and we cannot forget the divisions of the past, but they have led to something new. And I think that newness is what we all love about Montreal. It's a vibrant city. It's a city where its different languages is stimulating. It's something we want, and it's something that we have come to appreciate. And we all go to other cities and we say, this is fine, but it's not Montreal. Because Montreal has that je ne sais quoi, which is that heritage of division, but that has given birth today, I think, to something that is very different.
You know, here we are today, and we're all sitting east of the Main, and we're in the auditorium of the Bibliothèque Nationale, and we're conducting this interview in English only. And I'm wondering where the simultaneous translation is into French, which would normally mark Montreal civic space in such an event. So how would you describe what we're doing today? I mean, is it a translation without a translation, or what's happening?
Yeah, that's a hard one.
I seem to be asking the hard questions, and you thank Pierrot for his. So I'm sorry, but maybe
I think it's a mark of maybe I could just tell this as a kind of a little bit of a narrative, maybe. When I talk in the beginning of my book about how I grew up in a very divided city, and I felt I had to go away, and I went to Paris and came back to Montreal, and at that time found that the attitudes of Anglophones in Montreal were very difficult for me to identify with. There was an organized political resistance on the part of Anglophones, which I found offensive, because I didn't feel that they spoke for me. And in a sense, I wanted to give up my membership in the Anglophone community, and I spoke as much French as I could, and if I went to the movies, I'd make sure that whoever I was speaking to wouldn't speak in English. I wouldn't betray my real identity. I would, you know, I really tried as much as I could to speak French and not show who I was. You know, I tried to pass as a Francophone. And now I'm much more comfortable speaking in English again. I am not uncomfortable to be here in the Bibliothèque Nationale speaking English. I'm very pleased to be here. I believe that I think it's a very gracious gesture on the part of the Bibliothèque Nationale. And I think that English, in a sense, has changed meanings in Montreal. I think that 1975-76 was very much a watershed event, and many Anglophones left for whatever reasons they felt they had to. And those of us who stayed made a pact with Montreal. We made a pact. We said, we're living here. Perhaps we speak English, but we're living in a French-speaking city. And we acknowledge that we're living in a French-speaking city, and we will speak French, and we will be... citizenship in the city is a French-language citizenship, which admits of minorities, but that is the language of democracy in Quebec, is French. So if we speak English today, it's an English that's changed its identity. It no longer, it's not, to me, and hopefully this is shared by others, it's not the colonial language it once was. It's a language that accepts its second-tier status in Quebec, and therefore we can speak it much more comfortably.
Thank you very much.
Now we have an opportunity not to end the interview, but to broaden it with possibility of people in the audience asking questions of Dr. Sherry Simon. So we have two microphones, and we have lots of time for this process. And so I would just invite anyone from the audience who might have some questions to ask Dr. Simon to somewhere or other. There is the microphones floating around. So I'm going to facilitate this process as best as I can, even though I'm having a bit of a hard time seeing out there. But yes, okay, we have one down here. You might...
My name is Joel Barg. I'm interested in literature, quite a bit of it. And I have an integrated question here. English writers use Roger's thesaurus to embellish the language. What do French writers use? Who is the most renowned of the thesaurus gatherers? That's one question. The other is an English book of 100,000 words would require 40% more words in translation. Can this be dealt with?
Thank you.
There is no equivalent for Roger. There is no equivalent for Roger. Nobody is. I don't know if they've done it in other languages, but Roger's Thesaurus is one of the great, you know, masterpieces of conception. You know, it has 100 categories, and every word fits in those 100 categories. It's a beautiful book, and I think one should read it from. There's no equivalent in French. And as for the length, I think my colleague here would answer that.
We made a survey in Translation Bureau. And the French is, it average 11% longer than the English version, not 40%.
Hello, my name is Chantal. I'm a future student in translation at Concordia. And I have a question about your work. Like, through your translation, what have you discovered in the psychology of the Anglophones and the Francophones, if you consider the number of times the expressions come back or the words come back in one language or the other, like the vocabulary that Anglophones will use and the French will use, because I've noticed that, like, also as a French teacher, that my students will ask me, how do you say that in French? And I say, well, it's funny because it's not an expression that we use that often. Like, yeah, so that's my question.
So the question is,
what have you discovered in the differences between Anglophones and Francophones in the aspect of the psychology or sociology? Like, how do they think differently?
Yeah, that's a big question. I don't think there's anything such as there used to be an expression in French, le génie d'une langue, you know, that each language had its own character. This is a very Lumière notion. Madame de Stael wrote a lot about, you know, the French think this way and the Germans think that way and their language is like this and their other. So I think that within each language, there are infinite variations. We were talking about French and Quebecois, and the same in English. You know, you have competing varieties within a language. So it's not so much the psychology of a language, I think. I don't think a language really forces you to do very much. I think you always have freedom within your own language to speak in different ways. If you have different psychologies or mindsets, I think they have to do with generations. They have to do with... they have to do with occupations. They have to do with, you know, the milieu in which you live. So I hesitate very much to make generalizations about psychologies based on language.
Two recent writers have observed a similar observation, and they say that you can observe the crisis of any culture can be observed when its elderly crosses the street to avoid meeting its youth. Applying the same principle to the conversations of Montreal, how do you think, or what is responsible for, and you can say this, of either an avoidance of a crisis between the two cultures, or is there a celebration that the crisis has been avoided and we're now in a process of celebrating that meeting of the different cultures? And what is responsible? Is it the influx of many other cultures that have sort of been the lubricant for the meeting? Can you identify what has been responsible for avoiding the crisis, and now be in the point of a sort of celebration? And at what point do you see us moving towards a different level, seeing that we have gone through that earlier type of meeting of English-French, and where are we now? Where do you see the future of the city as far as a part of the future of the conversations? Where does the conversation now proceed?
Thank you for a very, very interesting comment. I think you've, you know, really hit the nail on the head. And, you know, what is it that allows us to celebrate what only a few generations ago looked like it might be heading for some sort of confrontation? There are economic reasons for sure. There's the fact that, you know, Montreal was once the capital, the financial capital of Canada, and now it's the, you know, cultural capital of Quebec. Many things have changed historically, having to do with institutions, having to do with the political evolution of Quebec, and with the empowerment of the French Canadian, you know, industrial elite and their own and the what's been called as the economic conquest. There's a book by Mark Levine called "The Reconquest of Montreal," where he talks about you know, the economic takeover, the slow rise of power of the Quebec bourgeoisie. So I think there's been a move that we can measure from the 1940s and 50s until now. In fact, that's the question I really was trying to answer in my book, with it, because I start off with the notion of the divided city, and then I say, well, it's not divided now. And you start off with these story like Malcolm Reed crossing crossing town, and this is an extraordinary thing to do, and it no longer is. You know, we now have we have a business francophone business person who's going to speak French in the morning and English in the evening, and who's going to move from the West Island, where he now lives, to the Maine at night to have a drink. More mobility. I think the separations of the city have broken down, the physical separations, and I mean, we can even talk about how the metro has made that change, because you can burrow under the city now and travel great distances that you couldn't before the metro. So many different kinds of changes, I think, have led from what was once confrontational to now, to what now looks like a celebration, because I think there's a certain cultural confidence in the Francophone community that allows for these differences. There's also the fact that the English language itself has changed meanings. The English language used to be identified exclusively in Montreal with the certain historical rights of the English language community in Montreal. Now, English in Montreal is international English. It's that language that people speak in Germany, that people speak in India, that people speak all over the globe. So this international English is no longer the kind of the enemy or the antagonist that that first kind of English was. So there are many reasons. There are many reasons why things have changed. And where do we go? Well, I guess that's the question. One of the things that I also asked in the book was, when you look at the history of multilingual cities throughout history, you look at Alexandria, you look at Istanbul, you look at Vienna, you look at the great, you know, cosmopolitan capitals of the past, they're monolingual now, almost all. Why? Well, Constantinople was the capital of an empire, and then it became the capital of a nation called Turkey. And now you have to speak Turkish and not all those other languages, Greek, Armenian, etc., that used to inhabit that city. That's you know, sort of one after the other. If you look at the history of these great multilingual capitals that we so, you know, venerate as models of what the urban life should be, they're no longer that. So how do we avoid the same thing happening in Montreal? If this is what we treasure, if this is what we love, which is the encounter of different languages and the ability of all of them to live as citizens in this city, how do we prevent that historical thing from happening? I can't answer the question. I can only ask it.
Yes, right here. We'll just wait for the microphone. Just the microphone's right behind you there. Thanks.
This is more a political question. Okay, we had an election, and most all the English voters with the Liberals, and the others, the French, with the other two parties. Now, I'm wondering, the Prime Minister here, he sort of takes it for granted that the English will vote Liberal. Now, do you think that with all these changes that there's going to be a time when the English party will not just stay with the Liberals, they're going to go with the other parties and see what the other French parties have in their thing? And will they change? Or will they still be taken for granted as always going to be Liberal?
it's an disagreement. I'm not you know, that well versed in politics. What I know is that was apparently always somehow the expectation with various immigrant groups, with ethnic groups. And in this election, we were told that many of the ethnic groups were also changing their allegiances. So certainly nothing prevents the same thing from happening in the English language community. I think it's an interesting thing to envisage.
Hi. I guess I've recently developed this interest in literature and its relationship to urban our identity as citizens of a city. So I've started reading only books that take place in Montreal, English and French books. So I've been asking people everywhere for recommendations of books that take place in Montreal, and almost all of the English books that people recommended to me tend to be older, I find, like Mordecai Richler, Leonard Cohen, and the authors that you mentioned as well tend to be, you know, a few decades old already, and I found very little recent English Montreal fiction. And I don't know if this is just because I haven't looked enough yet, but I was wondering, do you think it's possible that maybe in our literary tradition, we're still, in English at least, we're still very much stuck in the time where those divides that you were talking about were very strong and very real, and that there is very little in the English literary tradition in Montreal that actually explores the new city where the divides aren't as strong? And if so, do you think that that's just a natural lag, or is there something, some reason for that?
Good question. There is a time lag, because there always is. Even before the urban novel came in French, for instance, for a very long time, the novel of Quebec was Le Roman de la Terre. Even when Montreal and urban experience was very much more the experience of most of the majority of the population was living in cities, and the novelists were still reading Le Roman de la Terre. There is a funny décalage that happens. At the same time, there is a lot of new fiction in English in Montreal. And at Blue Met, if any of you went to the Blue Met Festival 2 weeks ago, there was a very nice panel on new fiction. People like Rawi Haj, whose book, The Nero's Game, well, it's not about Montreal. Okay, that's true. But there were a bunch of other writers who are becoming more prominent, who do write about Montreal. So there is a new generation of English language writers coming up. And it's true that that other generation that was set for such a long time identified as Montreal writers. I mean, there was a time, interestingly enough, where the best, the most interesting Canadian fiction was being written in Montreal. That's the generation of Richler and Callahan, and I mean, that was a really rich period in Montreal writing. but it was resolutely English language Montreal writing, and there was very little crossover. One book that's often not given its due is Morley Callahan's The Loved and the Lost, which tells a very different story. I've been talking about East-West, and often, you know, that is the main mythological narrative in Montreal is between East and West, but there's North-South too. And North-South is the barrier, that was what Gabriel Roy was talking about in Bonheur d'Occasion, was North-South, the Westmount, and the industrial Southwest below it. The Loved and the Lost is a North-South story. It's a story of Westmount and Saint-Henri meeting up. And it's a very, very interesting novel to read in retrospect, but in historical context. But there is a growing literature. If you look at the Blumet program and find the names of those writers, also the Quebec Writers Foundation does a really great job now in promoting English language writing in Montreal. And it's a scene that really is very active.
I'm curious because when I speak French, I feel as if I'm a different kind of person from the person I am in English. And I wondered if it's the same for you personally or as a translator. Do you feel freer in French? Or it's a very personal thing. I wonder if you have that experience.
For me, it depends on time periods in my life. There was a time when I really much preferred to write in French. But I come from, as was noted, I did my studies in Paris under Roland Barthes, and I came from that tradition that uses a very abstract French. So there are ways of writing in French where you really don't have to say a whole lot. You just say it very elegantly. And and you don't have to. There's a kind of a disconnect as far as emotions are concerned as well. I felt that reconnecting with English in some way was for me a way of being more intimate with myself as well. That was my experience. That English, but it came. It depends on the time period, I think, in which you use these languages and the reasons you do them. My academic life was, for a long time, mainly in French. So I would tend to have those abstract notions in French. And I think it would have been harder for me to write something intimate in French, whereas English was cut off from that world. But these are very interesting questions. Someone like Joyce Marshall, who was a writer and translator, said that why she loved translating was that she could get into a different, she could use a different voice, she could find a different voice through translating, she could become a different person. Because a translator is a writer, you have to write, you have to actually come up with the words and write them yourself, and you become the speaker of those words or the writer of those words. But it was a different voice, it was a way of getting out of herself and into another personage, and I've heard other writers say this, that translation for them is a way of keeping on writing, because if they go through a period where they're, you know, having difficulty, they're not coming up with original ideas, they can keep on writing. They're exercising their writing muscles, but it's not their own voice. So that's the way translation can be a kind of a ventriloquism as well.
This winter, this part of the Thomas More things, I attended a theater program, and a friend and I went to see Tremblay's play Assorted Candies, which was a bonbon assorti, I guess. It describes Tremblay's youth, his youth in a Roman Catholic primary education type thing. And we found that the translation, we're both bilingual, we found the translation impeccable, but the whole experience that he was describing, we were totally laughing, but our people around us were not picking up on it because it was the Roman Catholic French experience. I give an example. You know, when we went to school, we got stars, and we got so many stars we would adopt a Chinese child. This was not part of the English culture, and so how in translation, can one handle that? Is it almost like a different totally different text because it didn't come across to the English audience in the same way as it would to somebody who's actually experienced that, because it didn't make a lot of sense. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
So it was like the cultural differences. The words were translated word for word, right. And in whatever colorful language, but a lot of the cultural differences in that play were not kind of transposed, if I can put
right.
it that way.
The laughter came from recognition, the other spectators would have understood, but they wouldn't have the same laughter of sort of that intimacy.
Of having experienced it.
I guess there's no real way around that. Sometimes translations become adaptations in which, you know, the actual events are transformed into events that a public will recognize and will identify with. But I think that part of the interest of a translation is precisely to have those moments that you don't recognize. I mean, some you will have had the pleasure of recognition, whereas others will have had the pleasure of meeting a reality that they didn't know about. So there, I think you could, you know, measure those two different experiences as different, but not necessarily one being worse or less pleasurable than the other.
Jim, and then there's also another question down here in the middle.
I wanted to try to make a connection with a couple of things. On our website, at the Thomas More website, we have a selection from Eric O'Connor. It's 100th anniversary of his birth this year, one of the founders of Thomas More. And one of the selections that's there is about the in-between, which is a theme that's in Eric O'Connor. And some other thing comes to mind. We did a course a couple of years ago where we talked about Alice, and Alice passes through the door, and sometimes you get caught in the middle. Not Atwood talked about not, you know, going into the dark side or the dream side or coming back to reality. So could you talk a little bit more about a translator being in between or caught in the middle, or what's that like, and is it risky, is it reassuring, is it debilitating, is it exciting?
Thank you. I think it's probably all of those things and more. I think we used to think of the translator as an exceptional being, you know, someone who lives between two languages. It seems to me that nowadays we are more and more, all of us, living in that in-between space. If you live in Montreal, you are inhabiting that space, and it's part of our lives. We can call, you know, the translation is a condition that we live with. It's a condition that we don't suffer too much from. I think it's rather on the contrary, it's a condition that enriches our existence. On the other hand, there are other aspects, other kinds of translation, which have involved a great deal of suffering. When we talk about the in-between, the individual who's the immigrant, who has been forced to immigrate, someone who has been obliged to leave their home and has to translate themselves into a new environment, this can be a position of suffering, which doesn't necessarily imply some sort of cognitive privilege. There's a very, very wonderful novel by a woman called Eva Hoffman, which is called Lost in Translation. Nothing to do with that silly movie. It's a very important memoir that she was born in Poland and immigrated to Canada when she was 13 or 14. And she describes what it was like for her to acquire the new language and to become a new person. And it's a very, very lovely, it's a very lovely book. But at the same time, it shows you the kinds of pathos that people can suffer from being obliged to translate. So I think that the space of the in-between depends very much on whether it's a chosen space, whether it's a freely lived space, or whether it's a space that's imposed by forces that one is not necessarily comfortable with. But I would argue that it's more and more the space that we all inhabit.
Yes?
I'm curious about something. We often hear that the writer has to leave home in order to have the distance to see where he came from. And I'm wondering if you're suggesting that there's a bit of that just in crossing the main by coming into touch, say you're English and you go into the East End and seeing the French culture makes you understand your own a little more.
Yeah, exactly. I think you've said it very well. In fact, those voyages that you know, people felt obliged to take, whether it was to go across continents, there's one writer, Adrian Rifkin, who talks about it's the differential time. It's not how far you go. It's the sense of how different. It's the sense of how far you've gone in time. And it can be just going next door. It can be, you know, it can be the relationship between neighbors in the same neighborhood who live completely different cultural existences. But in the case of Montreal, it's laid out for you. It was given to us. That sort of template of the divided city was given to us as the space of exploration, as the space where you could go away. There's a wonderful line from a novel by Constance Beresford Howe, who wrote it in the 1950s, and she talks about leaving her husband. And she says, I'm going to go to Rue de la Visitation. She said, no one will ever find me there. I mean, it's, you know, it's just a... And the idea that you could go and lose yourself just across town, because no one would ever think of looking for you. Especially in that, you know, particular sort of savoureux that she would do that because she was looking to escape from her old self. But that's it, I think. It's the idea of finding a new self in a new milieu or escaping your old. But the possibilities are huge, and that's why that kind of it's a gift. It's a gift that we can, or that one can work with to your advantage, hopefully.
Eileen?
I just have a question as well. I was brought up in the Mile End as well, and I wonder whether one of the things that happened to Montreal was the fact of the immigrants moving from the Mile End and going either to the East End or to the West End, because my family moved to the East End of Montreal, and we were part of the French milieu. Our neighbors were French, while they sort of realized that we were from another immigrant group. Whether that made a big difference in regards to how the divide started to break apart, because it was people moved. And I think at one point they said that Montreal didn't have ghettos. But, you know, we sort of moved to the East End. People from the Mile End moved to the North End or to the West End. And wonder whether that changed also helped that break up that divide.
Yeah, I think you're very right. There are, and more immigrants. We're getting more and more immigrants. And immigrants have entered into if I can use that term, Quebec cultural discourse in a way that's now very different. There were always immigrants in Montreal. There were Jewish immigrants, but somehow the immigrants were, again, like the natural incline that Pierre Antil was talking about. The immigrants were kind of naturally part of the purview of the Anglophone community. Anglophone scholars talked about immigration. Francophone scholars were interested in something different, in the emergence of the Francophone nation. Well, what happened with Law 101 and the subsequent changes was that Francophone scholars woke up to say, wait a second, now the whole city is ours. That means that immigrants are part of us too. And there was a huge wave of enthusiasm to study immigrants, to include immigrants in political discourse, of course, as you know, to try to sort of entice them into the... whether it be the sovereigntist camp or another, but to take into account the fact that Quebec society was now a majority Francophone society, but that it included all these other differences as well. So the perception and the participation of immigrant groups in Quebec society has gone exponential. So yes, I think you're right. It's very important.
Aline?
Okay. You spoke briefly about the existence of novels that were written in English and French together. And I have run into one. But on the other hand, we've been talking about how, in a way, they're different worlds that you respond differently to. And so I just wondered how you would see a future for a book that's has characters talking in two languages.
Which novel were you referring to?
I can't remember. I think she was a Westerner. I can't remember. It was a woman, a Canadian.
Oh, Strayer or something?
It's not Nancy Houston?
No, it's not Nancy Houston.
Allison Strayer?
I
think that those kinds of novels will always be, in some sense, I don't know if they'll become the norm. You know, I think they're part of that kind of perverse playing with language and being on the borders. I'm not sure. It depends, I guess, to what extent the new generations are, in fact, these people who move effortlessly from one language to the other. I've just finished a novel by a young black guy. His name is Fimo Mitchell. He self-published. It was very interesting. It's called Lost and Found. And it starts off where he's in the schoolyard in a French school. And so it's in English, but everything that happens in the schoolyard, he uses French. And it's just very close to, you know, that sociolinguistic reality that he was living. And of course, to us Montrealers who read it, it's just true. That's just the way people talk. It's the way that generation is being brought up. They may speak English at home, but they'll speak French at school. And so that kind of thing, that kind of mimetic copying of reality, that will, as long as there are populations who and groups who speak that way, there will be novelists who repeat that. Mm-hmm. But that's different from, let's say, you know, playing more with styles or actual narrations in different languages. Those would be different. Another step forward as well.
Thank you.
Yes? Do you find yourself sort of lost in the tension between words and translating humor? Will it become a scientific endeavor for the translator, or do you just let it go somehow? It's been building up in me. I'm trying to figure out, what do you do with that? Do you feel responsibility?
Would you like to answer that?
Perhaps I have something to say. I translated a feminist book once. And I a feminist book, feminist theology book. And one of my friends, was a woman, told me, "You'll probably drop some of the meaning, because you're a man." But I discussed. My wife read my translation, and we had a lot of discussions. And I think I would say sometime I was angry. I felt the anger in some of the chapters. And I think, after it was published, I met women who said, "Well, I found all the sensibility in it." I think, does it answer your question?
Was that a discovery for you as the translator? Like, how did it affect you?
Well, I must say, when it was published, I don't know if you know Marie-Claire Blais, she wanted to meet me because she said, "I don't understand how a man can feel women's feelings." And I said, "Well, I don't know, if some injustice is committed towards a human being, I feel the same if it's a woman or a man. I feel like I identify myself with the person." So that book, I felt strongly. The book wasn't just feelings. It was a lot of facts and theories. But I think I didn't have... Well, it helped discussing with my wife. It helped a lot. because of her experience she put into my reading of the book. But I wouldn't have needed that, I think. But you need a special empathy to make sure you understand what's behind the words.
Will we lose some of the delight of the divided city if we bring it together too closely? Or are we to live on the edge a bit?
Yeah, I think there's no danger of that quite yet.
Thank you very much for... one more question, and then we'll finish there.
I couldn't resist. I heard the interview with Michel Garneau this morning on CBC.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I heard that too.
And it's because he spent a bit of time with Leonard Cohen that he was able to appreciate, and they could talk as friends. And it's only when you have that intimacy that he was able to translate. Can you imagine anyone in this room, including yourself, having to translate Leonard Cohen? I mean, that is difficult in itself. But he did a fantastic job. But yes, you're right. We're quite far apart from, we don't have to worry about losing either one of them.
Not yet.
Thank you. So on behalf of Thomas More Institute, I would very much like to thank our panel tonight, particularly Dr. Sherry Simon. I'm about as Anglophone as they come, so I'm... My mind has really been altered tonight. No. The interviewers, I'd really like to thank Pierre Lambert and Diane Moreau for their penetrating questions, which really, I think, facilitated our encounter with Dr. Simon. Cities, I think, provide opportunities for the face-to-face encounter, and I think that we were really given an opportunity tonight to encounter Dr. Simon. I also think that there's a strangeness to cities that allow us to experience something about a continual opportunity for creativity that happens in new beginnings. Sort of being on the margin somehow allows that. And I think that Dr. Simon's work, the juxtaposing of the complexity of language and the complexity of cities, really provides us with a glimpse of that creativity that cities can really generate. So I very much would like to thank you, Dr. Simon, for your wonderful responses and the book, and very much thank you. So we have another interview next week, and there's information about that as you leave tonight. Thank you.